book is based on multiple trips to Central Asia, really beginning in 1997 and all the way through until the late 2000s. Most of the information was collected during a year-long stay in both countries in 2002 and 2003. Main point of the book is to try to understand how the country's agricultural economy has an outcome on the capacity and the stability of these states. And, of course, there's plenty of material written about conflict diamonds and wealth and how that can contribute to violence and can contribute to instability. And I was wondering how that works its way out, how that occurs in Central Asia, where you don't have these kinds of resources. The two main questions that started the book is, number one, why Uzbekistan did not experience state failure while Tajikistan did in the early 1990s, and specifically why Tajikistan's internal security apparatus and police and other offices seem to fragment and divide, while in Uzbekistan those same offices became well-developed and larger in size and, in fact, in many ways, far more expensive and even in some areas far more effective. The later question that emerged over time is how it is that after the 1990s, these countries continued to be ranked as extremely corrupt, and yet they seem to be remaining fairly stable. And what is it that holds them together? So the primary argument is that in the early 1990s in Uzbekistan, and later for both of these states, the ability of these countries to provide local leaders and local economic and political leaders with access to what we call rents, or income they can derive, illicit sources of income they can derive from their control over local economies, the ability of these countries, the ability of these central governments to allow those local elites to access those rents and turn their control over resources into very profitable enterprises, profitable for themselves, that binds them to the central government, that keeps them linked to the central government, so they're less likely to defect and mobilize. That's what existed in Uzbekistan, and that's what failed to occur in Tajikistan in the early 1990s.
So in a way, the governments were trying to make sure that these, let's say, the business elite stayed loyal to them. They were essentially, through the rents, they were buying their loyalty.
That's right. And there was two things that really made it possible for Uzbekistan to do that and Tajikistan not. The main starting point is that in Uzbekistan, the agricultural resources are much more evenly distributed across regions. And in Tajikistan, there's enormous inequality. The eastern parts of Tajikistan, which are very mountainous, have very little in the way of agricultural resources. What is currently known as the Rasht Valley is known for fruits and vegetables, but not obviously cotton production, and same for Badakhshan, corn of Badakhshan. So that was one reason. The other reason is the ability and the willingness of the central government in Uzbekistan to allow for and enable widespread rent seeking. Why allow for the local elites to access these avenues so they can obtain these profits. And they implemented a number of policies. They provided financial assistance to these regions initially in the 1990s. They gave them a lot of autonomy in how they would not necessarily trade legally, but allowed for some smuggling across borders from the Fergana Valley into other countries, and that's partly because they didn't have the capacity to control it, but also because they were willing to allow those things to occur in the service of social stability.
In the Karimov government, what is interesting is that Professor Markowitz, he moved very quickly, as you write. He did this without necessarily reforming the system.
That's right.
How did he do it? How much support do you think he had internally to be able to do that? Obviously, he needed to rely on some forces, right? The groups.
That's true. Although I have to say that we really don't have much information on what went on in the decision-making apparatus in the center, and none of my research was able to really access that, nor did I really try. I think that perhaps There was a real concern in 1989 over the instability that had occurred. There was obviously, over time, a lot of concern within the leadership in Uzbekistan about what was transpiring in Tajikistan next door. And probably that had a significant impact on leaders in Uzbekistan and made them more willing to fall in line. But I really don't know exactly how that transpired. We do see evidence that there was a lot of autonomy provided to the regional, provincial, and therefore district elites, especially in the resource-rich, the cotton-growing areas of Uzbekistan.
Mm-hmm. Explain what immobile capital is. You define it very well in your article, but just for our listeners, it might be very interesting, your take on this. Obviously, immobile capital, you mean cotton for Uzbekistan, right?
Pretty much cotton. It could include grain, and there's a little bit of rice production, but mostly cotton. The basic point about immobile capital is, it's a very simple point, that these are products that are very difficult to transport and get to market in a profitable way if you're trying to engage in smuggling. And if you contrast a bale of cotton with a handful of diamonds, the diamonds are very easy to transport, very easy to smuggle, and they're very lucrative when you bring them to market. So the nature of the cotton economy, the nature of cotton production generally, is that it's very bulky. The value you get for selling your cotton at the marketplace is pretty small, so it's very difficult to smuggle. And that means, and the implication for the analysis is that it means that local level leaders have, especially former collective farm chairs and local economic elites, they have total control over those resources, but just controlling those resources doesn't enable them to translate that into illicit forms of profit. And in order to do that, in order to translate that into illicit forms of profit, they need to rely on patrons and protection within the government.
What are the main weaknesses in the system right now?
Well, in the case of Uzbekistan, and to a lesser degree in Tajikistan, the main problem is that especially in the case of Uzbekistan, as it became reliant on using rents and using access to illicit profits for binding local leaders, district and provincial leaders to the center and keeping the regions linked to the center, when you rely on that form of corruption, it eventually erodes the institutions of the state. So in the short run, and even in the medium term, you may have social stability, political stability, but the cost is that it erodes and destroys state infrastructure, it erodes and destroys the political institutions, rule of law, the judicial apparatus, the economic administration. The administration is designed to monitor economic activity. And that in turn creates rising social and economic inequality and may lead to popular discontent. There are two forms of state power in this particular area of controlling the economy. One is maintaining a control in terms of stability, and the other one is being able to implement your decisions as you make them. And yes, social stability is maintained in Uzbekistan, but the weakness is that you're not able to really implement and carry out the decisions that you make in the center, because the regional elites, the provincial elites, are not willing to see those through.
What's interesting in Uzbekistan is that you don't really see anybody other than President Karimov himself as being a leader. I mean, obviously, there are many business leaders, regional, but the state media don't really talk about them. So, you know, people don't really see the faces of those leaders. You know, out on the street, people talk about certain powerful figures in a certain area. But when you look at the bigger picture, President himself is the main man.
That's true. In terms of making decisions and also in terms of making appointments, appointing people to positions within government, of course, there is enormous power concentrated under the presidency and therefore under the current president, President Karimov. But that's just in terms of making decisions and in terms of making appointments. the actual ability to implement and carry out those decisions on the ground requires a lot of people, and that includes people in the center, but also in the state infrastructure, in the territory. I think that even though you don't hear too much about these people, I think they are crucially important.
They are sort of those invisible rocks of the system that president relies on.
That's right. That's right. And the president and the central government has clearly demonstrated an awareness of this. They implemented a number of reforms in Uzbekistan in the late 1990s designed to reestablish control over the regions. And this is an ongoing struggle for them. They implemented fiscal reforms, and they were much more aggressive in appointing and dismissing leaders. And then they spent a lot of time building up the what we call the coercive apparatus of the state, the prosecutors, the police. They modernized their facilities. They gave them far greater discretion over the economy in terms of the powers that were accorded to these offices. They created a much more extensive tax inspectorate. And these were intended to promote and advance the ability of the state to implement decisions and to gain control over various aspects of the economy. But the problem is that as it did that in the late 1990s, it found that it was unable to truly carry out those reforms as they had originally planned, because they had originally, from the early 1990s on, had begun to rely on providing access to rents and access and providing those access that access to rents as a way of binding local elites and provincial elites to the center. The very tactics that they had originally designed or put forward to preserve social stability has been very difficult to overcome.
Would that machine, that complicated machine, be able to exist and run itself if President Karimov is no more? Because, the change in the leadership is going to happen. What would it take for anybody who takes over to sort of keep it going or keep the whole system together?
We've now seen a good 20 years pass where there are established practices and an established kind of standard operating procedures, ways of doing things. But on the other hand, it requires someone with a lot of skill, a lot of finesse to be able to balance the competing interests from different areas of the country and also from different parts of the economy. That will be a real question as to whether the person who comes into power can, number one, be able to rein in a very well-developed coercive apparatus, and number two, be able to manage this complex economy that includes not only cotton production and all the complexities with that, but also the other areas of the economy, such as uranium, gold, and the small and medium-sized businesses that are being developed. I think those are two areas that the leader will, whoever it may be, will really have to show an ability to have expertise in handling both of those. And that's not a lot of people will be able to do that.
Thank you for talking to us, Professor Markovitz. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you.